I'll present many topics, and if I will be questioned, I'll just stick to what is more interesting. Actually, there are many topics in this talk. This is what I specifically asked about this one, talk about this one, starting from this one. If there will be no time for others, I just keep on. So it's a most recent work, which again I was asked to talk about, which I did not plan actually. It's attempt to enhance effects of axions using atomic transitions. Traditional method pioneered by Hirsi Kiwi is to use magnetic field. Yeah, but see, it's kind of, this is attempt to use a combined method, which say axions are produced in magnetic field by detected in atomic transitions. It was kind of motivated by experiment on light shining through wall, because I wanted to do better. And I'll tell you what happens. So my original idea was just to use interference effect. So you know its interaction constant is very small. So we can try to do the following. Instead of light shining through wall experiments, where axions are produced by photons, by laser, in magnetic field, then there is a wall which completely absorbs photons, axions pass through, and then in magnetic field it transforms back to photons. So here it's kind of combined approach. We can absorb part of the photons, but I'll tell about this later, but for simplicity, we just produce axions, then we use interference between the photons which created axions and axions in the capture, because atom may capture both photons and axions. So interference effect is linear interaction strength. And I worked on interference effects for years to study parity violation in atoms or in nuclei, because you can't see it without interference because weak interaction is too weak. But its interference effect is first order and interaction constant were well detected. So here, basically the same idea. So what's the difference? We measure different interaction constant. It's due to electron axion interaction. So it's not a competing experiment, it's a complementary experiment because we are measuring a different interaction constant. So again, my first attempt was to use this transition. So it's angular momentum zero of atom with parity plus, and angular momentum zero with parity minus in excited states. Yeah, it's a typical clock transition. There are many atomic clocks working on such transitions, zero plus, zero minus. It's forbidden for photons, so you need to do something to open it for photons. You can use hyperfine structure if it's it's a typical way in atomic clocks. They use hyperfine structure, which interaction with nuclear spin violates angular momentum electron angular momentum conservation. So this transition is very weak, but allow it. Or in this case, it's better to use magnetic field because it has give us control of what's going on. So you apply second magnetic field in a detection area, which mixes state zero minus with one minus. Yeah, and transition zero plus one minus is allowed. So we can apply magnetic field as big as we want, and we have a photon amplitude under control. So then we consider interference. And to separate interference term, we can change sign of a field which produces axions, or we can change sign in the field of which opens transition for photons. In both cases, interference term changes sign, so again, we have a control how to separate interference. Where, of course, where real story is always more complicated, so there is a signal-to-noise problem and so on, which I don't want to discuss here. It's discussed in details in the paper. But there is also another opportunity which I want to mention. This M0 transition is exotic one. For photons, again, you need additional fields. But we can use a convenient M1 transition, which is magnetic dipole transition, which is a spin flip. both photons and axion can produce this transition. So we cannot play the same way because photon amplitude will be too big. But it's still M1 is weaker than more strong electric dipole transition. So there is partial suppression of photon amplitudes here. But advantage of M1 that axion amplitude is actually bigger than NM0. It's approximately 1 over alpha times, 137 times, approximately bigger than M0. So you have allowed photon transition, but axion amplitude is bigger. But we still have too many photons. So this is a case when we need some semi-transparent wall. And Dima Butker liked to call it shining through a thin wall. So again, we have under control not so easy as in M0 transition because you cannot easily change the thickness of a wall. But still we have photon capture under control. We still use interference. And this long story with signal-to-noise ratio give us an indication that this method may, in principle, I would say in principle, because real life is always complicated, be compatible, competitive for axion mass smaller than 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. And this is wonderful graph produced by my student, a comparison of existing data with kind of projected data for axion photon interference. So in a certain area of axion-like particle masses, it may be competitive with existing data. It's a conclusion of this work, which I don't want to go into details. Again, if someone is interested, I'll discuss it in private with all these stories, because there are many parameters involved. The density of a gas, there are many widths involved, some which affects the results, like collisional width, Doppler width, and so on. It was a little bit discussed in a talk yesterday about before yesterday.
Where's the QCD axion
plot? I have no idea. Somewhere lower here. It's not plotted here. It's not QCD axion. I think it's still a long way to go to QCD axion. So it's not that optimistic as I hoped for.
We can ask a few questions about
that. Yes, of course you're welcome to ask, but if you're interested.
So one version is to have not interference, but just axion production and then detection with atomic transitions.
Yeah.
And you did some calculations for that. We don't talk.
No, I know your work about this. Actually, I was a referee for it.
You realize it's being recorded, everything.
Yeah, I know. But also, I wrote a positive report. That's what was keeping silence. I appreciate the great offer, so I didn't even read it and write positive report. Okay,
so let me ask you comment. Okay, the interference idea looks very good. But when you look at the noise, it's usually not that good.
Yeah.
It's because of the shot noise.
Yeah, yes.
In the
I completely agree with this.
Yeah.
This is, I tell, it's not as optimistic as I thought. Because signal to noise, you cannot gain interference effect when you consider signal to noise. It's another advantage there, which can be used, yeah. So,
How much of the original photon beam did you let through? What's the right figure?
Well, see, this transmission coefficient simply cancels out in a single to noise ratio. So it's a matter of technical convenience.
I see.
How you can detect.
So it doesn't matter how bright the photon is.
If my experience with parity violation, if it's too bright, it's bad because systematics starts to dominate, not statistics, but systematics. Because from a statistical point of view, it does not matter. But from systematics, it does matter. But on the other way, if you observe them completely, if you make very weak signal, it's hard to detect it. You need special, some photon multiply and so on. So
do you have a feeling in reality where you would be very weak?
No, optimum will be, again, from parity evaluation experiments, photon amplitude 5 orders and bigger than axion amplitude.
So how much bigger?
5 orders of magnitude. It's kind of optimum, yeah. But again, it's so practical. So only after people will really do this, it may be decided. Because there is a balance between detection. So it's always nice to see a signal all the time, rather than to detect one axion per week or something, one axion per month.
And that 10 to the 5, the axion versus the photon absorption goes into that?
Yeah. So
is that basically 1 over that ratio?
So interference term 5 is smaller than total absorption, total absorption probability.
So I'm just trying to get a feel for where the 10 to the 5, why is it 10
not? No, it's just experience. It's not from nowhere. Because again, a similar question was on measure parity violation. That was also interference effect and some polarization of light, linear polarization of light rotation. They need some, when rotates, they put a polarizer which select a small signal. Again, when you have its opening too big, it looks like it's good because any photomultiplier is detected, but there's too much systematics. If it's too small, you don't have a signal, you just don't see anything at all. It's just experience.
And for the M0 transition, you said that the axion, the amplitude was larger by a factor of alpha inverse to absorb one axion.
M0, amplitude is smaller, approximately alpha time for optical frequencies.
Mm-hmm. And what about for the M1 thing you mentioned? What's the ratio there?
What?
You said M in your slides, M1 might be even better.
M1 is better because axion amplitude is bigger.
So, but what's the ratio there?
M1 amplitude, this is parametrically, it's extra fine structure constant.
Oh, M1 is bigger.
M1 is bigger. Uh-huh. Because a different path of interaction works. Here, for M1, a spatial path of interaction works. Sigma dot K. So it's just pseudo-magnetic field. For M0, it's a time component of interaction mainly works. Different parts of interaction because it's four vectors, a dot product of four vectors. You can use spatial components or time components. They produce.
Which component are you using for the M0?
A time component.
So what's the interaction?
Sigma dot P, parity evaluation, exactly. Similar to parity evaluation. Sigma electron, P electron. For
M1
is sigma electron P axion.
And what's the ratio in the M0 case, and what's the ratio of the photon absorption to axion absorption?
It's like anything. It depends how many photons you get. But it's a technical question: how detectors work, how many photons they can capture, because if there is detector noise also. If there is
for
no...
For your optimized thing, what would you say?
No, again, from experience, 10 to the 5, but I wouldn't, because so equipment changed since that. Maybe photomultiplier are more sensitive, because if signal is too weak, photomultiplier starts to produce its own noise. So you just want a signal bigger than this noise.
Can you describe your signal a little bit more? It's like counting, and you're measuring the rate, but there's no way to tell that what the axion mass is, because it's just a rate.
No, it's a shining through wall experiment. Okay. It basically doesn't depend on axion mass.
Right, so you can't tell what that is, and you can't, it's just a normalization, so you also don't have any way to...
Because its frequency is much bigger than mass, so mass is not important.
It's just a rate
measurement.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a naive question. Should I think of this as you're creating a coherent state of a photon and an axion?
No, it's just usual laser. Yeah, but the point is the axion is produced by the same laser. So we can easily interfere. Initial state is the same photon, and final state is the same. So it's an excited atom. So they interfere. The only thing with for M1, I did not mention, if you average over all the M1 components, effect vanishes because different multiples do not interfere in the total cross section. So you need always select specific Zeeman component. So you still need magnetic field. It's easy to show that in the absence of external field, different multipoles do not interfere.
So I was just wondering, why do you need a thin wall? Can't you just have new photons on the other side, just clearing the photons?
Yeah, okay. This is the second question. This is another attempt. So, okay, I'll finish with this topic. These are the atoms we considered. These are famous atomic clocks, calcium, strontium, not so much barium. Okay, it's atomic clocks and some other elements, so we consider many of them. Noble gases may be good because we just can have a big pressure of them. And for M1, we just consider the same atoms which we used for parity evaluation because I'm familiar with them, but it may be anything. It's just because I know for sure that lasers exist, very good lasers exist for these frequencies of M1 transition, just transition in between fine structure components. Because fine structure increases with nuclear charge when, roughly speaking, Z squared alpha squared over some 13 electron volts. So in these atoms, M1 frequency happens to be in a good laser range.
For the alkaline earths, what M0 transitions are you considering?
Sorry?
Which M0 transition are you considering?
S squared, S electron, 2S electron to SP, S and P.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily. For example, for xenon, there are holes, because xenon is a closed shell, so it will be P to P electron excited to S, and there will be P hole S electron. But basically, it's always S and P orbitals involved. Because I don't want to go into atomic physics in details, because again, it's very familiar stuff, at least for me. For high energy physics, probably is no interest in which. So another, what we mentioned, can we use another laser? It's a wonderful possibility, but because it was suggested for detection of photons, and we were fantastic rate, one photon per week. Maybe detected using this technique, so we attempted to consider it, but actually we didn't. We only mentioned this possibility. It's just interesting, therefore I tell about this, how it can be done. Instead of using the same laser light, you can completely absorb initial photon and shine by other lasers, but on a slightly different frequency. Why slightly different frequency? We want to have beats. So our interference term will have beats, additional beats with a difference of frequencies. And when you detect this linear in bit frequency signal, and you kill completely main photon signal. So instead of using a wall here, you use a selection of fixed frequency. And it looks very tempting again. You have only interference term and no main signal at all. And again, the authors who detect axions, they managed to detect one photon per 100 seconds, but promised one photon per week. So it, again, if it works, it's fantastic, but I don't know how well is this technique, because it looks a little bit exotic.
How would the detection work in this heterodyne?
They kill the main signal and only detect frequency of bits, linear interference term.
But how would you do that?
Just they average over. No, in practice, they change kind of average signal change in frequency with frequency of bits. So they plus and minus are averaged.
So what's the beat frequency that you
would use? I just don't remember what frequency they used. But the point, they demonstrated it for 100. They detect one photon per 100 second, successfully detected, so separated from any noise.
So the beat frequency is 10 to the minus 2 hertz?
No, I forgot it. I simply forgot it, I don't remember.
But I still don't understand how you detect this. It's just you look, as a function of time, you see more signal and then less and more?
You have this signal, yeah? So you just change sign here, so to average it. To average it, only detect so there is a signal, which is never zero, yeah? But you average it, so you exclude constant signal and only see first harmonic. Only see first harmonic, which is interfering.
What's the time scale on that? I still don't understand how you're doing it.
I don't remember time scale. I don't remember. I can look into paper and check. I just don't remember it. It's probably sufficiently high. It's not.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. 100 hertz, but I don't remember it because modern electronics successfully work on megahertz. But I don't see a reason why we need very, very high bit frequency.
But the rate at which you're detecting things is very low, right?
Yeah. So we can detect one photon per week.
Right.
Okay, here it will be one exon.
That's why I don't understand.
Here it will be one exon per week.
Okay. But then I don't understand how the heterodyne would work.
No, but okay. You don't even say that what you're actually detecting is the fluorescence photon. After your case.
It may be fluorescence photon, but people prefer to use laser to measure population, a second laser to measure population of upper state. But the method of detection, again, is so well.
That's very obvious.
It's again, for atomic clocks, there are so many techniques and techniques to detect this weak transition. They just use a second laser to count number of excited electrons.
So he just correlates the transition time with this sign, and you can do it over any length of time. It doesn't, you know, it can be once a week or once.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Even if it also is.
Of course. Yeah. Okay. So it's just a possibility, interesting possibility, because people promised. Excellent result. Again, it was not about axion detection, but we measured. We simply measured a small number of axions. Here we want to measure a small number of photons. Here we want to measure a small number of axions. Okay. So another attempt, again, it's attempt to do something which is similar to magnetic field, but using atoms. So it's an attempt to measure axion using forward scattering. So it may be production or detection here, both. So usually this effect happens in magnetic field, but we can use for same purpose atom. So atom can do the same job, basically. Yes, absorb photon, emit axion, absorb photon. If wavelength is big, is bigger than the distance between the atoms, it's a continuous media, like glass, for example, or air, continuous media. So, and there is, because there's continuous media, there is mainly only forward scattering. So an effect will be proportional to lambda squared, similar to production of axions in magnetic field. So amplitude is proportional to length, and probability is proportional to length squared. So therefore, the problem is convenient to present as effective field, because the problem with magnetic field has been solved. We just consider what kind of effective field you can produce using atoms. Just convenient method of presentation. It's not a real field. So you know, normal Lagrangian, which is used, is gamma interaction, axion gamma interaction constant, axion amplitude E dot B. Yeah. Here there are two terms. It will be because it's atom work, so it's interaction of axions with electrons. Axion amplitude, electric field from photon times some effective magnetic field. Yes. Plus magnetic field from photon, effective electric field. Because this effective field is just a resonance transition. Nothing else, just convenient dimension. But I hoped initially we can beat magnetic field, because when I was very optimistic, I used atomic clocks, and I could get an effective field as 10 to the 4 Tesla. But it does not work because of very strong absorption. So actually we ended up with effective field which is not so big, and the only use of this, if any, will be that it's a different interaction constant. So effective field is smaller here. It's 10 to the minus 2 Tesla or 10 to the 5 volt per centimeter is electric field. So it's, if the interaction constant is the same, it's not as efficient as magnetic field, which is a disappointment. But again, it's measurement of a different interaction constant. So it may be motivated by this fact that you can do a complementary experiment. Again, it's different field appears for M0 transition and M1 transition. So in one case you have B effective, in another case it will be E effective. So why there are two terms here? Because there are different atomic transitions with different parity. Okay.
So effective refers to the field created by the atom itself?
Yes, it's just, it's absorption and emission, the same, yeah.
And E and B without it would be the external.
Yes, but it's always convenient to reduce the problem to previous one. So I formulate in terms of effective field. Okay, but
there's a weak field to split some levels or something?
Yeah, you need, again, you always, they do not interfere in absence of external field. Different multiples do not interfere in general. If you average over direction, average over projections, yeah, you always need some field. So you apply weak magnetic field. Well, not weak, it doesn't matter. Just split Zeeman levels. Or again, Dima Butker, who is experimentalist, can say, okay, we don't need magnetic field. We can polarize atoms in a different way. It doesn't matter. But it is always should be a specific transition between different projections. Otherwise, if you sum over all of them, effect vanishes.
Since you estimated this effective field, did you see some way in which they could be enhanced?
Yeah, this is I hope to, because it seems a resonant transition and atomic clocks has very small width for atomic clocks, resonance. So a resonance absorption is inversely proportional to width. But atomic clock widths, it's Hertz, for example, you get a huge effect. Effective field maybe, again, 10 to the 4 Tesla, even bigger. But when you consider specific, so you need also, what is the disadvantage of atoms in general? Magnetic field does not absorb photon. Atoms do absorb photon. So you need to do something, a limited amount of material, or do some different tricks to suppress photon, which we discussed recently.
This is in a resonant case.
Yes, resonant case, yeah.
But off resonance, then you still have some control over the material.
Yes, yes.
And does that give you any chance to enhance it? I mean, by choosing the atom or...
Yeah, again, we did a very limited work, the simplest transition. Maybe it's possible to do something better. But it's the first work which just appeared, so we submitted it a couple of days ago, basically, a week ago. So maybe it's possible to do better. We used the same atoms because we just have numbers already for the estimate. Maybe it's possible to do it better.
Any absorption's a limiting thing here?
Yes,
absorption
and diffusion. Because usually the problem with photon is faster than axion, yes, normally. But in the media, like in the glass, photon is slower than axion. So absorption and diffusion is a problem.
By diffusion, you just mean that the dispersion relations are...
Yeah, because it goes out of phase, there is a some factor. Okay, so I didn't want to spend too much time on this because I don't know will it work or not, but at least it's something to think about. Another topic, it's just out of curiosity I tell this, because I was really surprised by this fact. So actually, completely different topic. Effect of photon mass on galaxy rotational curve instead of dark matter. So I just say what I mean, yeah? So this is famous picture, you've seen it a million times. So this is for baryonic path gravitation, and this is something which we observe, some flat curve. So of course it's the best argument, at least initial argument for dark matter. Now there are more. So is there any way we can explain this without dark matter? With no, again, practically within standard model, but only one difference, we use massive photon instead of massless photon. And we need very, very small mass. It's 6 or something smaller than limit on a mass term. So there's no contradiction with the measurements. It's just out of curiosity. If I would really believe it, I would take it more seriously. But there are so many evidence for dark matter. So one fact you cannot kill it. But at least interesting, maybe there is some further development in this. So if what happens? It's not mass of a photon which give you effect. It's change of magnetic hydrodynamics. Maxwell equation change. And the force, you can easily get force which is strong enough to exploit rotational curve without dark matter. So what's the difference? Maxwell equation change. There is additional term here. It's called Maxwell-Prakar equation. It's a Compton wavelength of a photon. No, the mass of a photon squared here. So there is one term here. If it's only magnetic field, this is not important. And what we see, this is experimental fact, or observational fact, that there is always magnetic field everywhere. I know that the origin of magnetic field in the spaces between galaxies is still debated. But inside the galaxy, there is plasma and there is a magnetic field, which is randomly changed direction on a big, very big scale, but direction is random. And magnetic field is vector potential over some typical distance from dimension. And we call this distance correlation length of magnetic field, how rapidly it changes direction. And this length is big, it's some parsecs. So now we write Maxwell-Prakar equations for magnetic field. There is extra term here because of mass. This equation is the same. Then we calculate force, magnetic force, with current cross magnetic field. Substitute current here, and you immediately see that there is extra term in the force after substitution of current. And it has opposite sign to magnetic field. This is due to mass. So easiest way to get an answer without some long magnetic hydrodynamics equation is just to calculate Maxwell stress tensor or energy momentum tensor for magnetic field. Zero component is energy density. Has sum of the terms. Magnetic, this is term, usual term, and this is term due to mass. So if you use vector potential as B times L, there is extra terms here, M squared, L squared. But in the space components, which is usually associated with pressure, we have opposite sign of this term, like here, opposite sign of a force. So we have B squared, Y minus M squared, L squared, opposite sign of a term. If mass is zero, pressure is energy over three, which is famous equation for massless particle. Pressure is energy over three. It's usual relation. But in a situation when this correlation length is very big, we have an opposite case. M squared L squared may be much bigger than one. And so we have negative pressure. We have pressure minus energy over three. So it's somewhat similar to dark energy. So very easy to get negative pressure inside plasma if photon is massive. Okay, so this is what we wanted.
Then the plasma collapses.
No, 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 it's a stable plasma. There's no collapse.
So what keeps up? It's stress tension, right?
Yeah.
So what keeps it up?
It rotates.
This is what keeps up. It's a rotational.
Yeah. This is what keeps up. This one, rotation. We want to explain this flat part of the curve. So if we did get this equation, interesting equation of state, momentum is minus epsilon 3, we have a gradient of pressure, produce attraction towards center of a galaxy in galaxy plane, and imitates gravity. Simple estimate shows, because this length is known, correlation length is known, what kind of photon mass we need. And we need photon mass of order of 10 to minus 24 electron volts, and the limit is 10 to minus 18 electron volts. So we can continue this story, say what are magnetic fields, effects of magnetic fields for acoustic peaks, shift of baryonic oscillations, or some other effects. And again, I'm not expert, but I know that there is some empirical relation, that while there is relation between mass, baryonic mass and velocity for galaxies. It's a purely empirical relation. It's different from Kepler law, but still it's this flat part of a velocity curve is determined by baryonic mass only. I'm not sure, because I'm pretty sure now that it's not everywhere, some kind of probably average relation. So one can say that it's simply mass of dark matter is a function of baryonic mass due to formation process. They have kind of formed together and...
Does a photon mass anywhere between this 10 to the minus 24 and the bound work? Or does that have to be a specific mass?
No, for this is a number, because we have this one. Because we know it's in our galaxy, we know galaxy rotation.
So you want it to be 10 to the minus 24?
Yeah, it's a specific number which gives us correct rotation curve.
That's right.
Yeah. Well,
this mass arise as a result of it being in plasma? Is it like a plasma?
No.
It's primordial?
It's initial mass. It's mass in the Lagrangian. I don't want to go into details. You just put mass and violate gauge invariance. Or you can try to do it in a different way, like there is a Stückelberger mechanism with extra scalar field to keep it gauge invariance. But for this purpose, it doesn't matter. It's just change of Maxwell equation, whatever you achieve it.
Where does the current mass bound come from?
Also from cosmic measurements, from a magnetic field behavior.
Your force only applies to charged particles.
Yes.
So neutral particles don't feel this.
Neutral particles don't feel it.
So then, what do they don't feel the gravitational field? I mean, this is all.
Yes, it's for plasma, only for plasma.
So,
only for plasma.
So then there's going to be a separation between charged particles and neutral particles.
Yes, maybe. For example, stars fly away from a galaxy.
Is that okay?
They're formed. No, this is just... I don't think it's okay, but when the heavy stars are in equilibrium with plasma, because their lifetime is small, and during the period of rotation, they're in equilibrium with plasma. Small stars, they're long-lived. They're not in equilibrium with plasma. After they're born, they should have a different orbit. Yeah, so it gives you some limit how far this can progress. Okay, so for a moment it's just curiosity or new limit on the photon mass, whatever. But it's interesting that you can so easily get negative pressure, which is some kind of dark energy behavior with only introducing one parameter, photon mass. Okay, now I come back to main topic of my talk. Effects of dark matter in atomic phenomena. Variation of fundamental constant, violation of fundamental symmetries. It's mostly work done with my PhD students, Evgeny Stadnik. It's a big number of works, and some works also involve other co-authors. Large number of works, so whatever. I don't know how far I can progress, but at least I give you some flavor what is going on. The motivation, if you consider scattering, you have in amplitude, two effective charges, or two interaction constant, cross-section, four effective constant. This is probably a reason why we still don't see dark matter. It's high-order effects in interaction constant. But what we want to consider is linear effect. Instead of second or fourth power, we have linear effect. So it may give you enormous advantage. We already got improved limits in some interaction 15 orders of magnitude, some 30%. Because we can see the linear interaction. It was recently was very nice introduction to this topic. Again, maybe Persikivi can tell better about this than me, but what we have here? We have practically classical field if mass of a dark matter particle is small, because density of dark matter is fixed. If mass is small, we need to have many dark matter particles. If you have many particles within wavelength, it's a classical field. Like many photons make electromagnetic fields. And another interesting feature here is that kinetic energy is small, if we produce a small kinetic energy. So all these particles oscillate coherently with the oscillation frequency given by mass of these particles. So what we have as a result? Cosmic maser. So if this is true, nature made us a present. It's produced as some cosmic maser, some cosmic coherently oscillating field, which we may try to detect. Here there are two major branches. If a particle has Biro spin, then maybe vector field is basically the same. If the particles are scalars, effect of interaction is equivalent to variation of fundamental constants. I explain, it's very easy. It looks kind of suspicious, but it's very easy. Why it's convenient to present interaction with scalar particle as variation of fundamental constants. If you have pure scalar, the story is different because pure scalars interact with spin. So we need to look into spin-dependent effects. So it will be oscillating spin-dependent effects. Here, oscillating variation of fundamental constant. Here, spin-dependent effects. And people are looking for these effects for many years. So the first results are actually based on the accumulated data. They don't even do new measurements on the first results. Yet. So why it's so easy? Because I start from scalars. Usual mass term is mass times two spinners, yes? In Lagrangian, relativistic physics, this is mass term. But scalar also interacts with another scalar. So the interaction is similar to mass term. I wrote here phi squared just because the physics is more rich here, but it may be linear power field phi. So you just see these two terms, you combine them into one, and they say, okay, mass changes. Mass changes as a function of field. Again, it's only convenience because we already considered effects of variation of fundamental constants. We did all the calculations, so we don't need to do anything else because we know how change of mass affects our physical observables. And if its effect is linear, you have all these oscillations. If field is quadratic here, we have more rich physics because cosine squared give you 1 plus cosine of a double frequency. So we have this term, which contains amplitude squared of the field. And it will all slowly, because it's just universe expands, so density of dark matter changes. So it's evolution of fundamental constant on a cosmological scale. So naturally, we look into astrophysics to detect this term.
Just to orient myself, that term, astrophysics is more sensitive to that term than
you can do variation of
alpha on a year scale through.
We're both sensitive, but again, the natural way to look into where you can use atomic clocks also, of course, to detect slow variation, slow drift. But for this term, you have no choice. If you have oscillating effect, you go to atomic clocks, and they already looking to variation of fundamental constant. Oh, not in general, atomic clocks, interferometer, something in the laboratory. So, and you even compare the results. They're surprisingly very competitive. So the same with electromagnetic field. If you have interaction with electromagnetic field, it's effectively, you can describe it as a change of fine structure constant. We already considered it. Okay. So what we can do? The lattice density of dark matter was somewhere after creation of the universe. And the first reliable data we have from just before Big Bang nucleosynthesis, because it's in a ratio of neutron to proton abundances. So we know how ratio of neutron to proton abundances affected by change of fundamental constant. It's old problem, which we considered before. So then we can do the same for cosmic microwave background. It's also sensitive to variation of fundamental constants. Again, we know about this from previous measurements. And we can do atomic clocks and astrophysical transitions. We calculated how astrophysical transition frequency and atomic frequency in atomic transitions depend on fundamental constants. It was a big activity, it's an incomplete list of works, but basically all current activities in atomic clocks is based on our calculations. And it's very rich activity. There are many groups around the world because they have very good clocks and question what to do with them. Yeah, it's one of the major applications. It's a sport for them, yeah? There are different groups, how well they can measure frequencies. We calculated how frequencies depends on fundamental constants, so natural way of interpretation is just in measuring variation of fundamental constant. But we measured slow drift. Now a problem is more challenging, we need to see for oscillation of fundamental constant. It's maybe even easier, but we don't know frequency. If we would know frequency, it would be easier. But the point is we just reduce the problem to previous one, and people are looking for variation for many years already. They have some 10, 20 years of data accumulated.
I don't have any intuition for K. And for example, this is the same factor for highly charged ions that you shoot like.
For highly charged ions, it's bigger. Yeah. It's bigger.
What is the intuition on K? Like for strontium, it's I'm assuming that's the typical strontium clock, optical clock transition. It's tiny, and for a cesium clock, it's 3 on a hyperfine transition.
Because here, dependence on fine structure constant appears due to relativistic corrections. Because I wanted to show the next slide, but I explain now. You cannot use absolute measurement of frequencies, because absolute measurements of frequencies is a ratio of atomic transition frequency to cesium clock. It only measure ratios which do not depend on human units. Yeah, ratio of two frequencies. Therefore, this alpha is good, it's dimensionless, it doesn't depend on any units we use. So, in ratio of frequencies, atomic unit of energy cancels. So, if anything, it should be relativistic corrections, if there are two optical transitions. And relativistic correction increases as z squared alpha squared increases as z. So, it very rapidly increases toward heavier elements. Yeah. If it's hyperfine transition, magnetic dipole transition situation is different because magnetic transition is also already relativistic due to motion of the particles. So here you have alpha squared for free because it's magnetic interaction. Then because it's it contains magnetic moment of a nucleus, it contains electron to a nuclear mass also as a fundamental constant. It contains magnetic moment. So it's a more complicated calculation because here it's purely atomic physics. Here it involves QCD first, because you need to calculate how magnetic moments depends on fundamental constant, then nuclear physics, and only after that atomic physics. But anyway, it was done for a different purpose. We know the results. We can do better because, when we're doing atomic clocks, we just use existing atoms with some very narrow width, some long-lived transitions. But we can find a situation where effect is enhanced. And it may be enhanced very strongly. Like relative change of frequency may be 100 million times bigger than relative change of alpha. It's because it's relative change. For example, there are two degenerate levels in dysprosium. In the tables, we have exactly the same energy. And it's what is also important, the sign of a frequency is opposite in different isotopes. It's excellent for control of systematics. Because you can just cancel systematics because change of alpha, it has one sign, and change some systematics has shift of a level due to different reasons, other sign. So it was two degenerate levels. Here it's a relative enhancement. But you can have also molecules with relative enhancement. You can have highly charged ions. Highly charged ions, electron is closer to the nucleus. It's small, so relativistic effects are bigger. Velocity of is higher. So in highly charged ions, you also use some level crossing phenomena. So if you remove electrons, level moves, and at some point they cross. And in these highly charged ions, we have a frequency which is in the laser range, but effect of variation of fundamental constant is much bigger. It's a new direction. And one another toy, where a second special conference is this, is a nuclear clock. Again, nuclear interaction is much bigger, so all effects of variation in absolute in magnitude is much bigger. Some 5 orders in it bigger. So again, this variety was proposed to search for variation of fundamental constant. Now we can use it to search for dark matter, for oscillating variation of
fundamental
constant.
What's the largest K to any constant?
The K is not no, k, largest k may be infinity, but it's not much use of this, because systematic effects also may be, relative systematic effects also may be bigger. So for example, the biggest k so far we've seen is in dysprosium and in interferometers. In interferometers like LIGO, it may be even other orders of magnitude, several orders of magnitude bigger, because the phase is very big. But you always can see systematic effects in the relative change of frequency, because frequency in denominator and frequency is shifted. And for example, in dysprosium, there is a broad level. It's not clock transition. It's one of the level leaves a small, relatively short lift, so it's a broad width, so you cannot measure a very small fraction of the width. You should, frequency is not very well defined, yeah. But in molecules where transitions are narrow, in highly charged ions are narrow, in nuclear clock we are very narrow, because magnetic dipole transition in nucleus is due to nuclear magneton, and it's very small. So, it's, well, so two, basically two directions, to search for best clocks, which are very, very accurate, or to search for enhanced effects. You don't need very high accuracy there. In astrophysics, there is also, we also did a calculation in astrophysics where very efficient, because we have a big time scale for measurements, like 10 billion years, or in space, 10 billion light years. There was even claim of a change of fine structure constant in space. So you look in one direction, you see one value, in another direction, another value. It's still to be checked. But anyway, astrophysical measurements made a lot of excitement, made a lot of motivation for further search for variation of fundamental constant. Then there is many atomic clocks. It's only part of the results here, because there are a wonderful group around the world which do very accurate measurements. They don't see effect, but there is no contradiction with astrophysics, because they measure temporal variation, and in astrophysics we measure variation in space. We are linked because we are moving. We move towards area of bigger fine structure constant. So we are linked, but we move not very fast, only 10 to minus 3 over speed of light. So atomic clocks is need to improve accuracy by a couple of orders of magnitude to prove or disprove astrophysical results. But it's about drift of fundamental constant. But we want oscillations, so we want to measure ratio of two frequencies with different dependence on fundamental constant, otherwise effect cancels out. And precision of atomic clocks now approaching 10 to minus 18. It's the most accurate measurements ever done by humankind. Nobody knows why, but it's still there. And sensitivity coefficients are calculated. So what people need is just to, instead of slow drift, look for oscillating variations. And people just realized data. There was a Butker group who analyzed dysprosium with dysprosium transition with very high relative sensitivity. Because with very high relative sensitivity, you can use for comparison commercial clocks. You don't need 80 digits, 10 digits is enough with 100 million times enhancement. They can use commercial cesium clock, and there is two best clocks. It's rubidium and cesium hyperfine transition, which measured in Paris, and where I'm sure there are other results which have not been published yet, because there are several leading world groups which compete with each other. This is in Paris Observatory. Okay, so what we see here, this is for linear interaction of field with electromagnetic field, a significant improvement from these dysprosium measurements. It looks even better if you consider quadratic interaction. So this is scalar field squared, or maybe pseudo-scalar, because it's squared, it doesn't matter, with electromagnetic field. And these are, this is logarithmic scale. There is limits from supernova energy loss and fifth-fourth searches. And these are limits which we obtained from existing data. This is from cosmic microwave background, from dysprosium, from big band nuclear synthesis, and this is rubidium cesium. Gain is more than 15 orders of magnitude, because we can see the linear effect. And here it's higher power in interaction constant. So this is only reason why there is so significant improvement is because we can see the linear effects instead of higher power.
Sorry, how do the fifth force switches work for the field couplings, the square field? What's the fifth force? It's not single exchange of the field.
No, it's just single exchange. It's they just people using for deviation from Coulomb correction, deviation
right,
from
the
gradient.
Field only couples.
It falls a lot faster than the Aurora squared, so they basically aren't over the force bounds.
Yeah, that's why I'm sorry. That's why I'm curious about, right? I would assume there's no fifth force bounds on this.
No, that's in principle there is, but it's just k one over a cube. Exchange by two particles.
Right, but that's much less strongly constrained.
Yeah, yes, much less constrained.
So it really is just a rhythm of that. Prepare.
Yes, higher power of radius. Okay, so it's for interaction of a scalar field electromagnetic field. Then there is a similar picture for quarks. Again, big band nuclear synthesis. This rubidium cesium clock, because it involves strong interaction, it's hyperfine transition, which involves nuclear physics.
So when you're doing something like this, you need to kind of go from the quarks to the nucleons to the nuclei itself.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's a long story.
It's a long story
and it involves again CV, but actually I collaborated with particle physicists, nuclear physicists and atomic physicists to do these calculations. Okay. So the same with electrons. Again, significant improvement. Vector bosons, probably for the first time, we know something about the interaction of dark matter. The vector bosons, it's from big band nuclear synthesis data because weak freezeout temperature depends on weak interaction. Neutron to proton transition depends on the strength of weak interaction, so we know about interaction of dark matter with W and Z bosons. And from Higgs bosons, interaction with Higgs bosons. Here we can see the linear interaction because it's kind of more well known. Phi Higgs here. But we search for this from fifth forces, and this is from dysprosium and rubidium cesium results. So improvement is not still so dramatic, but it's still atomic clock give you better results and other possibilities to search for Higgs dark matter interactions. Okay, now. Even more exotic topic, but it was popular, so I'll say a few words about this. Instead of homogeneously distributed dark matter, we can have some, like for example, domain walls or some other objects of a cosmological scale, monopoles, strings. Now this is domain wall looks nice on the picture. So there is domain wall passing through Earth, can we see it? So in this case, it must be interacting dark matter, of course. If it's non-interacting, it cannot form anything, yeah?
Sorry, the domain wall itself, the equation of state correct to be dark matter? The domain wall?
Sorry?
The domain wall is not dark matter, right? It doesn't act like dark matter.
No, but people count it as a dark matter, in principle, because it contributes to dark matter density.
But it doesn't, domain walls don't redshift like dark matter, right? Domain wall, we can't have dark matter just be made out of domain walls.
Yeah, 100% not, probably not.
Depends on that we are extending over the whole horizon, because then, of course, the tension is different. But if they are just like more globs.
But what does it mean, that a glob of domain wall?
I don't know.
Don't
you use
the word dark matter
on the
slide at all.
Oh, sorry, use the word dark matter.
Also, there is another nice object like stars made from axions or something like that.
Sure. I agree that other forms of topological defects may suffice.
Yeah, so, but see, if you consider, in a sense, the method of measurements is the same, because it's still made from axions or from dilatons or from something. Yeah, so the only difference is a transient effect instead of oscillating effect. So you use devices, you maybe system of magnetometers. We try to consider pulsar timing for domain wall passes pulsar and change in frequency, atomic clocks or laser interferometers. Because it was nice, very nice introduction about laser interferometers, so I don't need to go to details. But just what may happen? You have, this is real and future laser interferometers like LIGO, Virgo. and domain wall passes by, it produces some changes. Then you can see in the phase change when domain wall passes by. And by difference with gravitational wave, it's, the speed of domain wall is much smaller. So previously we rejected this kind of signal because delay between the different interferometers will be much bigger, three orders will be bigger, because actually we move through domain walls because our galaxy moves, sun moves, earth moves. And so delay of signal may be bigger, but it's still maybe worth reanalyzing data. And we kind of make people interested in this topic to analyze existing data and try to find correlated signals with a time delay three orders of bigger than for gravitational wave. Then we can have small interferometers. Again, it was very nicely discussed recently. Our work was done several years before that, but still it's very useful. This discussion was very useful. And here, what we can have here for small interferometers, or like there is a single crystal silicon cavity, for example. Very, very nice cavity which can keep light and reflects light many times. So size of the system is small, but you can have a million reflections. No, normally it's 10 to the 5 reflections because you have very good mirrors there. And you see that phase is actually proportional to fine structure constant. Phase in this system. See, it's very easy to see because we have wave vector, omega over c, and length. Frequency is proportional to atomic unit up to numerical constant. Then length is proportional to Bohr radius. Bohr radius changes, you have bigger length. So Bohr radius cancels, and you clearly see is e squared over hc. So phase is actually proportional to fine structure constant. If fine structure constant changes, phase changes. So delta phi over phi is approximately delta alpha over alpha, up to relativistic corrections. So because we have very many reflections, it's effectively very big length. So phase in single reflection is 2 pi length over lambda. Length is in meters, lambda in nanometers. So delta phi, delta alpha over alpha. So for single passage is coefficient of enhancement 10 to the 7. Yeah, because phase is very large. Phase of a light in this cavity is very large. But if you have 10 to the 5 passages, you have 10 to the 12. So biggest enhancement ever seen. So change of a phase is 12 times bigger than change of fine structure constant. So it's a maximal enhancement for effects of variation of fine structure constant. You can look for slow drift, or you can look for oscillations. The data, this idea has already been explored, and they improved significantly some limits on interaction of domain walls with normal matter. So just using this silicon cavity and laser system, they improved significantly limits on the topological defects. Then pulsar timing. Well, it's more or less obvious idea. Pulsar is a nature-produced clock, which are pretty accurate. If you average, you get accuracy 10 to the minus 15. So when a topological defect passes by, you have some change of frequency, very small change of frequency, because interaction of topological defect with normal matter is small. Not just, they say, fundamental constant changes, so mass of a neutron changes, and therefore speed of rotation of neutron star changes. But there may be more interesting effects. It's called pulsar glitch, which has really been observed. So it's sudden change of a frequency of a pulsar. It's actually very small, but because it looks like a big gap, but it's the scale doesn't start from zero. So it may be 10 to minus 11 change of frequency, but it's still very statistically significant. So sudden change of frequency. So and in principle, it can be produced by domain wall. Because domain wall weakly interacts with normal matter, it can penetrate inside and produce this effect. So what may happen? There are superfluid vortices instead of a neutron liquid, neutron superfluid liquid. And these vortices are coupled to crust. And coupling energy is actually pretty small. Surprisingly, it's a macroscopic object, coupling energy about 1 MeV only. So a little kick may decouple one vortex and then cause avalanche of vortices and produce pulsar glitch. On paper, look nice and how to prove, but it was a topological defect instead of spontaneous. It's not easy. The only hope is that topological defects are identical, like electrons. Yeah, so you have the same perturbation which produces effect in different pulsars. Also, it may be affecting pulsar array, which is used to detect gravitational waves, correlated effects in different pulsars when the same topological defect passes by. We get people expert interested, but so far nobody analyzed data. We hope someone will do. So again, difference is spontaneous effect. Spontaneous glitch. It's the same perturbation and correlation between different pulsars and prism. Then what we can do, instead of using dark matter, we can produce it virtually. So it's basically produce new forces. Because if a particle, a dilaton, axion, scalar or pseudoscalar interacts with normal matter, normal matter is a source of these particles. And as we know, these particles change frequencies of atomic transition, for example. So it was a real experiment done. A big chunk of lead close to dysprosium clock and far away, so some oscillations. And you should see similar oscillation of transition frequency in dysprosium. So it's a real experiment was done. But there are also natural sources like sun and moon. Of course, they work in completely different range of distances. So when you can interpret results, you see the following. When the mass of intermediate particle is very small, the best limits are from sun. So it's Yukawa potential produced by sun. Then next range will give you moon, and for bigger masses, it's experiment, laboratory experiment, just move lead piece, 300 kilometers of kilograms of lead, close and far away from clocks, and try to see modulation of atomic transition frequencies. So this was real experiment done recently on this topic. Again, effect of change of transition frequency due to change of fundamental constant produced by the field, produced by massive body. Now go to pseudoscalar range. So here we need to consider spin-dependent effects. So it's completely different experimental methods because we need to consider spin-dependent effects. It's not variation of fundamental constant anymore. The simplest effect is axion wind or pseudo-magnetic field. The simplest effect. Because axions interact with spin, we move through spin through axions. So in our frame, we experience wind from axions. It's an interaction of spin with axion momentum. Because it's similar to interaction of magnetic field also interacts with spins. We can call it pseudo-magnetic field, just convenience. So it's oscillating pseudo-magnetic field which causes spin rotation, nuclear spin rotation, electron spin rotation. It's kind of simplest effect we can see. When there is a more sophisticated effect, oscillating electric dipole moments. Again, idea more or less simple, because it's known that theta term in QCD produces electric dipole moments of neutron. Yeah, here it's dynamical theta term. Axion is dynamical theta term, oscillating theta term. So it will produce oscillating neutron dipole moment. You don't need any new calculation. You just substitute change in theta into old formula, and you get neutron electric dipole moment. Then you can consider effects in atoms and molecules. Here it's not so direct because you need to consider mixing of opposite parity levels. Again, the story started much earlier because we calculated effects of different interactions, on electric dipole moments of atoms and molecules, different CP violating interactions. So, for example, you have electron in S wave, so distribution of charge spherically symmetric. You mix it with P wave due to some CP violating interaction, and your charge distribution becomes asymmetric. So you add this plus this, and you see asymmetric charge distribution with electric dipole moment. It may be anything. It may be nucleon-nucleon interaction to produce time and parity violating neutron dipole, nuclear dipole moment, or it may be interaction of electron, which mixes interaction mixes opposite parity orbitals. But anyway, it's all the same mechanism. It's induced dipole moment. In this case, axion field does the same. It mixes opposite parity orbitals and produces oscillating electric dipole moments. You may use even simpler analogy. You know that if you apply electric field to atom, it is polarized. Yeah? And electric dipole moment appears with no any violation of symmetry, just external field. Here, external field is axion field. It polarizes atom and produces electric dipole moment. And because axion field oscillates, you have oscillating electric dipole moments of nuclei, atoms, molecules. And experiments are underway that have been done. So this is just mechanism. So you can produce, there is neutron dipole moment, which I mentioned, but there is also time and parity violating interaction between nucleons. If there is axion field applied, you get a new interaction. You get new vertex, pi and n, due to this oscillating theta term, and you get oscillating nucleon-nucleon interaction, and you generate oscillating nuclear moments, like shift moment, magnetic quadrupole, electric dipole moment. And when electron interacts with these moments, it's a second step, and you produce atomic or molecular electric dipole moments, which are measured. It's one mechanism. Another mechanism is even more simple, but electron interacts with axion. Yes, so atom is polarized, you have oscillating electric dipole moment. It's a different interaction constant here. And the effect is only simpler, it's more direct. You don't need to produce nuclear and atomic electron dipole moments. But here is just directly polarization of atom by axion field. So I gave many talks about this topic before, but one of them was most successful. This famous NEDM collaboration started to do measurement. It's a big international collaboration which get limits on neutron electric dipole moment and mercury electric dipole moment. They did both. They did this oscillating electric dipole moment measurements of neutron and mercury, and they did axion wind effects. They did both, and they have not found effect, unfortunately, but they improved limits on interaction axions. Here with gluons, it's just dynamical theta term, it's measurements of electric dipole moments. So improvement in certain range of masses, three orders of magnitude, so it's not bad. For free, actually, they just reanalyzed previous data. Here, the reduction is shown, so you can compare. It's still far away. A little bit, yeah. Several orders of magnitude. So, but three orders of magnitude improvement in sensitivity to interaction constant. And this is axion wind effect, which is interaction of axions with nucleons. Improvement is not so dramatic, but it's still visible. So it's a real experimental result. So I gave them a talk in 2013, and in December 2017, or years later, they published data. And I became an experimentalist, not the first time, not doing anything, just because I told them to do something. Okay. Also, oscillating parity violating effects, the same. People measure parity violation in atoms. Axion field produces oscillating parity violation effects. Nobody measured it yet. We can explore virtual exchange and using existing data. So you can use electric dipole moments, which are measured. No, limits are established. It's axion exchange, but here it's not a simple axion because you cannot call it simple axion because there are two interaction constants here, pseudoscalar and scalar. So it's a mixed particle. Axion and another interaction. There are macroscopic experiments to search for these forces, and there are atomic molecular electric dipole moments measurements. But
just for the previous slide.
Yeah.
This is a spin-dependent measurement, right?
It's pretty stimulating effects.
But you need a nuclear spin for this?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
There may be electron spin involved. It's easier. There are both. This might be weak charge of a nucleus, usual if it's Z boson times an electron spin, or other way around. Nuclear spin and atomic effect. So from electric dipole moments, we have a very good limit on this scalar pseudoscalar nucleon electron interaction. So again, because the electric dipole moments have not been found, we can only get limits on this interaction. And it's slightly different story if there is extra Z boson, which appears in many models. You also can, from parity violating measurements, you can get limit on new parity violating forces or parameters of new extra Z boson from parity violating experiments. Here it's for extra Z boson in mediating nucleon electron interaction. Again, very, very significant improvement, many orders of magnitude for virtual particle. And this is for nucleon-nucleon interaction. This is a limit from cesium n-pole moment measurements. N-pole moment is parity violating feature. So nucleon-nucleon interaction produces n-pole moment. Here, it's n-pole moment due to hypothetical new extra Z boson. And final point, I think it's exhausting already, but it's a final point of my talk, just to show that physics is one science. Because it's about WIMP detection. Where this story appeared? Dharma collaboration claim observation of dark matter. Nucleon dark matter interaction was rapidly excluded, but there was a loophole that maybe dark matter electron interaction. Yeah? And people use some non-relativistic calculations for this electron dark matter interaction. And what we obtain, but actually relativistic effects completely change picture. They increase the cross-section up to 3 orders of magnitude. And it's not accidental. It's very nice physics behind this. Why relativistic effects are so dramatically important? So, sorry, last effort. I try to explain. So why it's interesting in physics? Because you know from quantum mechanics that adiabatic processes do not produce any transitions at all. Yeah? They smoothly change level, but they do not produce transitions. So, and dark matter particles are slow. They are slower than electrons and atoms, much slower. So it's a adiabatic perturbation, and it would not produce any ionization at all. But this is wrong, and the wrong is because adiabatic perturbation breaks down because of a cast in electron wave function near nucleus. Electron wave function knows that potential is singular. It has cusp near nucleus. So instead of exponential suppression, we only have power suppression. But this happens from very small distances, from vicinity of nucleus. If you can see the physics behind this.
We're talking about a collision with
collision with electron. Yeah, collision with electron, but its effect is due to cusp of wave function near nucleus. So when you consider behavior, how cross-section depends on momentum transfer, in non-relativistic physics it's 8 power of momentum. You just write integral, immediately see, there's no any calculation, but it's 8 power of momentum. So it's very rapidly decreased with momentum transfer. But because effect happens from small distances, electrons ultra-relativistic at small distances. Actually, even typically, it's kinetic energy is 40 times bigger than the rest mass near the nucleus. So it's really a relativistic problem. And the relativistic problem, you have completely different law. Instead of 8 power, it's 6 minus 2z squared alpha squared. So we have different asymptotic behavior. And momentum transfer for heavy dark matter is pretty large. Even particle is slow, because it's very heavy, momentum transfer is large. So we have an area of big momentum transfer. And we have dramatic change of cross-sections. So this was idea, and after that there was nice work, which is done mostly my graduate student Ben Roberts, analyzing this data and doing calculations. It's sophisticated atomic calculations. And we immediately found tension between gamma and xenon data. Basically, xenon 10 and xenon 100 data excluded this interpretation of gamma results by electron scattering. Combined. One of them does not include, but combined exclude gamma interpretation. And then there was xenon new measurement, xenon group new measurement, which came to the same conclusion themselves. They use our relativistic calculations and get very significant disagreement with gamma data. So that's all. So why physics is one science? You're solving some high energy problem, but you need to do proper atomic calculations anyway. Okay, so that's it. So a couple of previous, I just quickly repeat what I was talking about, if there's still any questions. There are a couple of new proposals how to detect axions. Main interest is not in what this proposal are really much better than generation in magnetic field. My main interest is because it's measurements of a different interaction constant. It's electron axion interaction constant. So in this sense, they may be competitive or even better than other experiments. So then very small photon mass may imitate gravity produced by dark matter. But it's only one effect when there are many effects of dark matter. So it's mostly effect of curiosity now. But if something have enough fantasy, explain all the effects, it would be very nice. Then there are new classes of dark matter effects which are linear in the interaction constants. Because nature, if this is true, nature gave us a present, produced some measure made of classical fields, like scalar or pseudoscalar, and we can detect these fields, linear effects in these fields. Because the effects are linear, we have up to 15 orders of magnitude improvement on direction of dark matter with different particles, and first limit on interaction with WZ boson. Also, this is for effects of variation of fundamental constant produced by dark matter. For spin-dependent effects, it's violation of symmetries, like produced by external field. So it's not real violation of symmetries. It's just when you apply external field, of course, the symmetry of your system is violated. Yeah? So this axion field is external field, which produces oscillating electric dipole moments, some Lorentz-Einstein principle violation, and so on, because it's external field. It's not a true violation of symmetries. It's because axion is external field, they imitate effects of violation of fundamental symmetries. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? We already have a few.
So for the phi squared interaction, you need to rule out just writing a phi linear term, right? So you assume there's some I don't know, symmetry, some Z2 parity or something.
I'm not sure I understand.
No, you put phi squared in the end.
Yeah, I just go phi and phi squared. It's just different interactions.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying if you say that it goes like phi squared, you need to say why not phi?
Both of them. It's most general term. There is a limit for phi also. There's limits for phi with electromagnetic fields, which are better than previous limits, but not 15 orders of magnitude better. And there are limits on W and Z boson, which are also linear and quadratic. I presented here quadratic because they're all quadratic. But we also obtain limits on linear, and they have nothing to compete with, therefore they are best. And there are limits with Higgs interaction, which is linear.
What if you put phi cubed?
I think you can have problems if power is too high. It's, it, because it's, it will be where we saw radiative correction will be so divergent that you but radiative correction tolerate phi squared because Higgs has phi squared interaction. So, but if you have a higher powers, I think it may be too dramatic disagreement with the measurements, with the divergences. So we don't go for power higher than phi.
Because it's not normal. I mean, even for phi squared, it's not renormalizable anyway. So you're talking about higher dimensional, right? You put this lambda there squared, so.
Yeah.
I mean, as a particle physicist, you need to say, well, we need to say why you put phi squared and not phi. I mean, people are, you probably don't think this is a
You can put both. And also, if there is one interaction, another appears in due to radiative corrections.
Okay, maybe I'm the only one who's bothered, right?
Well, I mean, you can impose various discrete symmetries on phi, right? Z2, this is Z3, this is Z50, and it's phi 5th to the 50th.
Okay. So that's more puerile to be written about.
Because our approach is purely phenomenological.
No, I understand.
Everything should be tested because
we
don't know anything about this, practically nothing so far, only limits.
Other questions? Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.